Okay, so we are within the pre-Aveilut discussions that we said we'll discuss as far as the stage of illness and so on. We completed the realm of Bikur Cholim and began touching on the halachot that doctor responsibility to take care of patients and heal patients. We mentioned at the end of last week's shiur that the Shulchan Aruch says that on the one hand, nitna reshut, it's permissible, and once it's permissible, he basically turns it into a mitzvah because of the element of pikuach nefesh. In other words, there is a question that one could raise. And there were opinions amongst Chachmei Yisrael, or those who weren't associated to the Ramban. Around the Ramban, there's a debate what his position was. But there were those who were more fundamentalistic and felt that Rofei Cholim Hashem, and that it all should be in the hands of God, and human intervention is a certain, almost a rebellion against God. What are you getting involved in it? It's not in your hands. But most opinions took the approach that a rapo yirapeh comes and teaches that it's permissible to have a human who is able to heal another human heal him. And not only that, but according to many opinions, and that's the Shulchan Aruch's opinion, that becomes a mitzvah. You could say it's permissible. If a person feels a need to turn to a human being and not completely put his trust in God, okay, it's acceptable. But no, the Shulchan Aruch says that there's a mitzvah in that, as far as definitely as far as the doctor is concerned, which led us to another discussion on the question of financial responsibility,
Getting
which
there.
determined that. Did you say something right there? Okay. Which is basically a function of some kind of permission to function as a doctor. The Makorot and Halacha speak of Beit Din because that was the public body that authorized things. And definitely at the time of Chazal, not any time of Chazal, basically up to about 300, 400 years ago, most medical knowledge was just basic general knowledge and attempts to create all kinds of things. It wasn't the deeper scientific and more methodological scientific approaches that exists in medicine today. In any event, then it was Beit Din later on. The Aruch HaShulchan already talks about the government certifying doctors, because by the time of the Aruch HaShulchan already we had much more medical knowledge. It's in the 1800s. And today also, the doctor has to be certified, and not only certified, but in the area which he deals with, he has to be certified in that area, which raises certain questions in halacha, what happens, and that's connected to obviously legal aspects as well. What happens to a doctor who this is not his area, but comes across a situation and there is no other doctor, and he's obviously in his medical training has been exposed to a particular kind of treatment or something that has to be done, and that, but that's not his professional area. That's not what he specialized in. Can he do things or not? What will he be exempt from responsibility? Basically, it should come down more or less to whatever the norms of society are as far as the permission to act. And here in basically, modern Western countries, there are very clear laws that direct doctors into what they are and what they aren't allowed to do and when. As far as the exemption from payment, there are some varied opinions, specifically if it's a complete exemption, which is the basis of the Ran, or others that say that there is a certain amount of responsibility, at least and therefore, in certain circumstances, one would have to pay. But even those who feel that there is a certain responsibility, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach answered that when a person of his own volition goes to a doctor, a medical professional, they would say, be it whatever professional aspects of it is, he's basically coming knowing that doctors are not infallible, they're not superhumans, they're human beings, and sometimes there are things that don't go well. You go into a surgery and it doesn't always succeed. And in certain circumstances, even you go into a surgery and there's always that risk that the surgery will cause even death. In that case, where a person definitely chose to do it, he is basically exempt the doctor from any responsibility. And the doctor would be completely exempt. That's basically the norm that is accepted. The flip side in the discussion is what the Shulchan Aruch writes in Siman Sham in Yoredeya, Siman Shin Lamed Vav, Seif Bet. A rofe asur litol sachar hachochma v'halimut. A doctor is not allowed to charge for his knowledge or even for his training as a doctor, but he is entitled to charge for the effort that he puts in and the what's called schar batala, the time that he invests in any kind of medical treatment, and it's time that if he wanted, he could therefore use it to make some other form of living. In that sense, the requirement here on a doctor is similar and somewhat parallel to what we find in halacha in reference to a rav, a talmid chacham. There too, there is a certain element of Torah should be given free, same way as a Kadosh Baruch Hu gave to Moshe, and Moshe gave to Am Yisrael the Torah without any kind of compensation, monetary compensation. So too, any person who teaches Torah should theoretically teach that Torah without monetary compensation. On the other hand, obviously, there is an issue of a person has to live. A person has to have food, clothing, house, and so on. And therefore, there already there's a big discussion as to what the parameters of permissible in this way or that way to take money for learning, for teaching, and so on. The Rambam is in that sense very extreme in his being reserved from any kind of financial compensations and is extremely against any kind of phenomenon that we would today call a kollel kind of reality. But most other poskim disagree with the Rambam and establish reasonable parameters to the fact that the person who can receive money for, especially once he is teaching, once he is ruling, halach ruling, whether as a community rav or as a dayan, he can receive money. But there again, it's all based on time invested or efforts that he has to make, similar to what we see here, the Shulchan Aruch talks about as far as the doctor.
And what's the reason for that? Why can't the doctor charge for his medical expertise like any other professional?
Let's see if I can find it for you. Sec. The Shach and the Taz bring down. Beidat gufohu, Shach comes and says that the illness is basically like some kind of loss of body strength, body capability, and therefore it's like an aveda. In other words, when you heal a person, you're returning to him what was lost, and it should be seen like an aveda. The taz adds to it the sort of completion. The amrinan b'inyan asiyat mitzvah ma'ani b'chinam afatem b'chinam. In reference to Hashavat Aveda, and there also there's halacha, you shouldn't receive money. You can receive a return on your expenses, but you shouldn't receive just payment for returning an Aveda, because the same way as HaKadosh Baruch Hu does it for human beings, b'chinam, so too he expects, when he commands about people, he expects them to do it. So these are all kind of...
Is this halacha like an asmachta idea? Are they looking to find a way not to pay the doctor?
No.
It jumps out at them as perfectly logical to simply not pay the doctor for his expertise.
On the contrary, the
rationale
for it. No, Bruce, on the contrary. The efforts, and throughout the generations, the efforts are to find the ways that the doctor can receive payment.
Right.
In other words, the accepted is that there is some kind of tradition. I don't know. Again, that's always a question when you come to issues of limud. To what extent is this a tradition that goes back to what the Rambam says, Moshe received Sinai and Kadosh Baruch Hu? To what extent those are limudim of Chazal with the tools of limud? But in any case, Chazal speak about this issue, and the efforts are on the other one.
You know, the doctors used to be the priests. If you look around the world in antiquity, when you went to the priest, you gave him some kind of an animal, like a corban, and he did what he did, and he also gave you some medical advice. It wasn't like there was a separate professional who went to medical school.
First of all, I don't know to what extent that was in Am Yisrael. I can't think of cases in Tanakh, right, where as a whole, you turn to a priest or something of the sort for the purpose of healing. We do have, obviously, you know, Pinchas with the Ketoret, but that's something different. And you have here and there another, you know, Elisha that brings this child back to life, but that's in a completely different capacity. It's not... So I don't know. I really don't know to tell you historically what occurred in Am Yisrael.
I think the illness was viewed as from God, and the way to approach God in antiquity was through the Beit HaMikdash procedure, which involved
not necessarily, because it wasn't. In other words, in Yahadut, it wasn't. You didn't pray to Kadosh Baruch Hu. You didn't turn to Kadosh Baruch Hu through the priest. The priest was the person who needed to do certain aspects of the avoda of the korban, but the tefillah was always the individual. And if anything, we find concepts of tefillah turning to chachamim for tefillah, turning to nevim, not so much to the priests. Yeah, because sometimes the priests are chachamim in there, but not because of priesthood. So I don't know. I don't know in the earlier periods. Later on, there is a phenomenon, definitely already in the Middle Ages. There is a phenomenon of study of medicine. Again, it's not scientific as we know it, but there was an element of study of medicine. Study of medicine, in many cases, was based on some kind of broad overall knowledge in whatever elements of scientific knowledge there was, and the, you know, philosophy and so on, which gave you the tools to approach things. But there were, in other words, there were, I think even the in reference to the Rambam, he studied somewhere that some of Chachmei Yisrael literally are in what's known as medical schools or medical apprentices to doctors in
and if you didn't have them, you had the The amulet writers. So in Eastern Europe, you ain't got an amulet if you're
But
a
that's,
monk.
but that again, amulets were not real, not real healing. In other words, it was a form of turning to HaKadosh Baruch
Right.
Hu. That's a different story. Now, to what extent, where the line between that and Avodah Zarah, where between Tefillah and that is already a separate question. In any case, the Aruch HaShulchan, trying to define the lines between professional knowledge and some kind of efforts, writes something very interesting. He says, obviously, which was common then, the time that a doctor goes to a patient's home, because then basically home visits were very normative, right? It's only really relatively recent that doctors don't make home visits. We have to go to their offices or to the hospital. Up to not that long ago, the norm was a doctor would come to the patient's home. So that time that the doctor has to come to the patient, see him, assess him, and so on, that time is something that he can charge for. The knowledge that gives him the capability to make the assessment, that he can't charge. But again, Havla, something into something else is always easy enough to pull on that. The Aruch HaShulchan goes even further and says the knowledge of determining what medication the patient needs. Again, let's remember the Aruch HaShulchan already is talking in the 1800s when there is a certain level of knowledge and systematic medication. The knowledge of the medicine that you're not allowed to charge for. But for writing out the prescription, the effort and the time of writing out the prescription that you're allowed to charge for. That's already effort, right? And that you certainly, if there's any procedure that has to be done and it takes physical effort, that would fall into what we talk about the tircha that can be charged for. There is, however, some interesting discussions in reference to this in two halachic areas. One is a question of Shabbat. When a doctor works for Shabbat, works on Shabbat, can he charge for his time, effort for Shabbat? And the simple answer is simply what we do in so many other areas is havlah. In other words, you get a weekly, a monthly salary, and that's inclusive. So we perceive it as you're being paid more for your work on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and you do your Shabbat for free. But there is an interesting comment around it. A doctor, Avram Sofer, he's a medical professional, wrote a series of books on medicine, Nishmat Avraham. And here he discusses what happens if, and obviously he was familiar with such a reality, where in the paycheck it would say the amount of money you receive for each particular day. I guess they were doctors who were being paid by days that they were working or hours they were working, and therefore it listed Shabbat this and this amount, right? Can you? So he spoke to Rav Neuwirth, the author of the Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchah Ba'an, and Rav Neuwirth said that it would be acceptable. He bases it on a Mishnah Berurah, and he says that even though it lists it as such, but being that the payment is one payment, you can see it as havlah, and he okayed it. That's one interesting question of dealing with the financial side of that as such. Another interesting question is, let's put it this way, okay? Definitely in the United States, but I think here in Israel too, doctors, Baruch Hashem, make nice livings. They're far from being in poverty. I think that many rabbanim and mechanchim would be happy to be making the kind of living that doctors are making. Is that permissible? Or where's the line? Okay, you charge for your time, but such large sums of money. Can you charge such large sums of money? And Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had a, or answered in the tshuva, an interesting point. He said, since this doctor, if he wasn't working in Shaarei Tzedek, if this doctor was working in some goyish hospital somewhere in the United States, the middle of the United States, he could be making a lot more money. If he had a private clinic in America, he could be making a lot more money. So therefore, you can see this as schar batala. In other words, you're now holding him back from being able to go and make that money. Therefore, he can be paid a nice, good salary here too, and that would not be problematic. But that raises an issue. In other words, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach here sees the idea of schar batala, the payment for the time he is taking up, as something that he can measure on a true capability that he has to make money. In other words, as a doctor, he could work now elsewhere from a goy, and from a goy he's allowed to take money, and he could be making X amount of money. So therefore, he's allowed to receive it even when he's treating Jews. This has two interesting ends to it. On the one side, on one end, measuring time, according to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, is not on a minimal fee. What we find in certain places, in certain halachot, that schar batala is a minimal payment of a person who sits and watches a field, right, and receives a minimal pay. No. He says the schar batala is the batala of his capability of making the money. On the other hand, he can't charge like his neighbor, the high techist, the high tech guy who's getting three times as much because he doesn't have that knowledge of high tech. So the what he comes and says, you have to measure the schar batala on the basis of what he as a doctor could alternately make if he was in a situation where he could make money, he'd be entitled to take money, like from a guy, for his compensation. So that's an interesting observation on what schar batala is, according to Shlomo Zalman.
Earned about 10% here of what I made in America. But in America, the insurance company sets the rates. And I had multiple clinics with X-rays and PT,
Let me
and
correct that,
things I
Bruce.
did not have here in
Bruce,
Israel.
let me correct that. The courts in the United States set the rates because they give such high compensation for malpractice, so that the
No, that's no. Insurance is
insurance
just
companies
different.
raise their prices so much that it's
No. There's a market rate of what the insurance companies pay. Nothing to do. That's a separate issue. And
and it's you're talking about people insured, not private.
yeah, insured people, right? In this country, I tried privately. There was no insurance for chiropractic, and there's a lower market rate. Period. In the States, it's set. There's a much higher market rate. That's all. The market sets the rates. The malpractice question had nothing to do with chiropractic. Thank God we're not in this
From a
field.
halachic point of view, okay, let's assume that your profession is within that realm of medical profession. From a halachic point of view, since you could use that same time, you could do like some other doctors or other people did in Efrat and fly back and forth between the United States and Israel. You could use that time and make that much more money in it. If you charged somebody for your time in Israel that much, that would still be halachically permissible according to Rav Shlomo Zalman. So that's the element of compensation, monetary compensation for this doctor does his he does what he's responsible for and heals a sick person. Here we move on to another area, an interesting halacha that basically comes up in a discussion in the Gemara in Moed Katan. You have someone who is seriously sick, and there is concern that if he were to be informed or to find out some bad news, then it would further his illness. It would put him at a risk with his life. A person who has a serious heart condition, or let's put this way, he's hospitalized now. He's recovering from a heart attack, and there's fear of the fact that discovering some bad news would set off and cause another heart attack, and his heart's too weak now to handle that, and he is at risk of death. Example. There, obviously, it's a logical thing that one would refrain from telling this person the bad news until he's stronger, until he's healthier. But in certain cases, that creates an element of halachic conflict. For example, since we're dealing with or leading to Hilchot Aveda, this is a classic example. This is where it comes up in Gemara Moed Katan. Meit lo meit. In other words, there is a sick person. Obviously, it's a chole sheyesh bo sakana, chole that has some kind of sakana if he was informed of this, some kind of danger to his life. And he now, a relative of his just died. He's theoretically required to practice aveilut. To whatever extent he can practice aveilut, you would have to practice aveilut. At the very least, if you can't practice aveilut, you would have to do the halacha of kriya, whatever expressions that he can fulfill, right? If he's too sick, he may not be able to sit on a low chair on the ground. That even certain elderly people have a problem, but definitely to refrain from learning Torah, that he could do, right? Kriya, no reason why he couldn't tear a garment of his. Kriya, by the way, is a separate halacha. We'll get to it then available, but to do the kriya. So now, on the one hand, we have a requirement to inform him so that he can fulfill his halachic requirements. On the other hand, there's an element of his being sick, and there's concern. What will it do? So now, if it was obvious, it was known that this telling him this would finish him off, then obviously that would be outright pikuach nefesh. But here we're talking about a situation where it's not 100% clear. Still, the Braita in Moed Katan teaches us that chole shemeit lomeit ain korin b'fanav. You can't do kriya even to yourself before him, Not only can't you do kriya before him, but you can't walk into his room with a torn garment. And this is reflected lahalacha in Shulchan Aruch in Siman Shin Lamed Zayin. Chole shemet lo met, ein modi'in oto. A person who's sick, obviously, a sick person who is there's a sakana and there's reason to fear that it might affect him. We don't inform him, we're not modi'a him, we don't inform him of the death. Shema titaref dato, maybe he'll lose his mind over it, obviously, and die from it. The ein kol'im chalukot, and therefore we also don't tear his garment. The ein bochim, the ein maspidim b'fanav. We don't cry, we have to hold back our crying over the dead in his presence. You can't be maspid, you can't speak of the dead as dead in his face. And we silence those who come to comfort him, but they can't say anything. And the halacha is, as I said, not only he can't or shouldn't do kriya, but the people who visit him do not do kriya. And therefore, for example, a person who is sick, okay, and his brother passed away. And a third brother comes to visit him every day. If that third brother were not to appear suddenly for a week, it would raise concern, it would raise discomfort with the sick person. Therefore, the halacha is that the third brother who is sitting Shiva not only can, but must. Perspective of Bikkur Cholim, must get up from his Shiva to go visit his sick brother, but he has to remove and change his shirt. He can't walk in with the torn shirt. He has to remove his shirt and come visit his sick brother, looking as he would have before the death. And he has to hold back any kind of crying and any kind of expression that would show the sick person that the third brother or the second brother had passed away. This raises an interesting question that again was posed before Rosh Hashanah. He's changed the shirt, right? Because he has to go visit the brother. As long as he's visiting the brother who's sick, he's fulfilling the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. He has to be with a garment that's not torn. But what happens after he walks out of the sick person's room? Now he returns to a state of avilut. But if he's an avil and shiva, the halacha is, especially if it's brothers, it's in the last, but if it was a parent, the halacha is that you, if you for some reason have to change your shirt, then you do a kriya on the new shirt that you put on, replacement shirt you put on. So now, theoretically, we have to do kriya on this shirt. That would be a rather demanding thing that every time he goes to visit the sick person, he has to do kriya. So Shlomo said no, that he is, since the entire aspect is an aspect of the need of the ill, he can go back or until he's with the torn shirt, until he can replace his shirt, he can remain with the shirt that's not torn. He doesn't have to re-tear the shirt. On the other hand, Shlomo Auerbach said, he's obviously allowed to wear regular shoes. So today, that's often less of a problem because there are enough shoes and sneakers and sandals that don't have any leather in them. It can be worn during Avelut, but when you walk in to visit the sick person, it doesn't stand out as you're wearing something because of Avelut, right? People who wear Shoresh sandals, right? Those can be worn during Avelut. So you walk in and nobody will notice that there's something different. Certain sneakers, many sneakers don't have any leather to them. So you could wear those. But even if you do normatively wear shoes, and therefore it would stand out that you're not wearing your leather shoes, so you can go in with those leather shoes. But says Rav Shlomo Zalman, the same way as we find in reference to a person who has to go a distance on Tisha B'Av, that what he should do is put in some dirt, some earth into his shoes so it's less comfortable. He senses the discomfort, right? So too he should do when he goes visit the Chole, because the Chole doesn't see that dirt in his shoe. But on the other hand, for him, it does bring out the sense of the Aveilut because of the discomfort in a situation like this. In any event, it's certainly clear that the priority, because of Pikuach Nefesh, is the well-being of the person who's sick, even where it's not a definitive kind of thing that's going to kill him. It's a suffix, it's a chashash. We're wary that it will be so. You do whatever you can to prevent it. I'll just add one little point to that, and that is that deciding when or not to inform a person of the death of a relative is not something that is very simple. And in many cases, we careful and maybe overcompensate. I always have before my face the story of my grandfather. My grandfather, in his last, I don't know, 2 years of life, or maybe it was deteriorating before, but the doctor, like in his last years of life, said the cardiologist had told him that his heart was working at 25% of its capacity. That's almost impossible. And when my grandfather asked the doctor, so how am I alive? He said to him, I think the only thing that's keeping you alive is your desire to keep on your learning. He had a chavruta in the morning and the evening. Someone came to learn with him. Your desire to learn. But he did live for quite a while on 25% heart capacity. And in that period of time, I know for sure of one sister. I think there was others, but there was definitely one sister who he was close to had passed away. And the family decided that he shouldn't be told, because when your heart's so weak and somebody's so close to you, you might really be affected negatively.
Can I add something?
Yeah.
Babish Rebbe had a brother in England who passed away, and his mother was alive still, and they didn't want to tell her. And he used to write letters to his mother all the time, every week. So the Rebbe would write the letters and have them posted from England.
So is it in this
To what
case?
extent you might go.
No, so that's exactly in this case, it wasn't. And then when the sister's son came to visit him one day, he said to him something. He said, "I know your mother's dead." So he said to him, "How do you know? Nobody told you." He said, "What do you think? I was so close to her." So first of all, you sense it. But he says more than that. There's no communication from her. My sister was so close to me, doesn't talk to me anymore, doesn't relate to me. What do you think? I didn't figure it out. So yes, the solution was to write letters. But even there, a person who's very astute and their mind is clear would probably pick up that something is not quite the same. But yeah, it's very complex. It's not easy, but definitely in short term, this is the halacha. The well-being of the patient overrides the requirement of fulfilling halachot, even in situations where it's not a clear cut one way or another. Before the end of the shiur, I'll move on to the next siman in Shulchan Aruch, which has to do with the vidu. Okay, halacha is, as the Shulchan Aruch uses the term, nata lamut. He's note that he's leaning towards death. Then we tell him it's time to say vidu. And again, the Shulchan Aruch says it, but it's already in earlier sources. He said to him, you know, it doesn't mean it's the end of life. Many people said vidui and then recovered, but reality at the moment is you're close to death, and this is your opportunity. You may not have an opportunity later on to mitvade, say vidui, and hopefully you'll still be able to recover and be well and live for many more years. This halacha, before we get into, certain definitions and identifying certain aspects, this halacha raises an interesting question in a broader sense. And that's the question of telling a person the extent of his illness. Do we inform a person how sick he is or not? And first of all, the reality is that it's hard to say one way or another in absolute terms. And one can argue one way or another. And Polsky, there are varied opinions in reference to what should be done. There may also be, there may be also a place to begin with a formalistic distinction of different stages of illness. And once again, Dr. Avram Sofer writes in his book that we find that there is three categorizations that the poskim speak about. One is someone who has a what he calls a machala mesukenet. In other words, an illness that has potential of bringing death, but can be treated and definitely to extend life and in many cases even to heal him from that particular illness. A second stage or a later stage is one who is an advanced situation of that illness, where modern medicine as a whole, its normative manner, does not have an answer that is perceived as capability of healing the illness. And basically, we get to a point where the only thing the doctors can offer is palliative care, making the patient more comfortable, less pain, able to live out whatever time he has in the most comfortable manner. There is a third stage, and that's what we saw in the Shulchan Aruch, and the Shach stresses that as a stage of development, and that is natalamut. He's already leaning towards death. In other words, this is very close to the time of death. And there's a sense of it could come any moment. Usually that means the person is very weak, the person is unable to do all kind of other things that he was able to do now, and Sometimes it'll take 3 days and sometimes it'll take 2 hours. But the life expectancy at this point is not very long. That's the element of Natan Lamut. Clearly, in the first two stages, it's not relevant to speak of Vidu. Vidu only comes in that later stage of Natalamut. However, in the earlier stages, there still is a question of informing the patient. Going back, again, some of these tshuvot go back 30, 40 years at this point. At that point in Israel, the tendency of the poskim was to refrain from informing the patient of the severity of his illness. Certainly, when it came to issues of cancer, there was literally this fear. It comes mostly from Hungarian circles, but there was this fear of using the term cancer. As I remember a friend of mine who grew up in this sort of Israeli-Hungarian environment, and he wouldn't say a person that has cancer. The machl, the known illness, right? The machl. But not, they wouldn't talk about cancer. And there was an avoidance. Was that?
Yedema
Yeah.
machala. The other machala, you know what I'm saying?
Okay. But there was an avoidance of saying anything about it. So first of all, even those poskim who follow through with such an idea not to tell the patient because it can worsen his condition, do require informing the family. But at that same period of time, there's an interesting letter that was written by Professor Shimon Glick. That is, for those of you who are more familiar, it's Yitz Glick's father. He's a professor of medicine, was a professor many years in Be'er Sheva. He came to Israel, but with a American background in medicine. And he writes a letter contesting or raising question to an article that Rav Aviner had written, taking the direction of the poskim not to tell patients. And in his letter, he deals with two interesting points. One is that not telling patients, at least in the stages when they're still functional, truly functional, medical studies show it was actually counterproductive. Because when a person knows what he has, and he knows this is the treatment, this is the way to deal with it, in many cases, he is calmer, he is more focused, and therefore psychologically able to support any kind of treatment given to him. And therefore, he contests that age-old approach and raises the possibility, and I think that it's become more accepted today, definitely in the stage of a person who has a serious illness, but it can be treated. And as he says, today we treat cancer with chemotherapy, radiation, things like that. You can't hide that from the patient. It's obvious to him what he has and what he gets. So definitely in those stages, you have to tell them. But even in later stages, the ability to live functionally, when a person knows and he can clear his table, in certain cases is beneficial. And there he leads to a second point, which is a fascinating point. where it touches on the vidui, the question, and I'll leave that, I'll deal with it a little more next time, we'll begin with that, the vidui as a form of accepting death. And the need to maybe go back to the sense of accepting death. It says, society has sanctified youth and well-being to such an extent that we run away from the sense of the acceptance of death as part of life. And that is part of his letter. We'll touch on that specific and connect it with the vidui and then Emir Tzashem next week. David's on, and I pass the banner to David for his shiur. Have a chodesh tov and a Shabbat shalom.
Chodesh tov.